now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Today, we got a lot of things to talk about. I wanted to talk about the School of Frankfurt because it has a lot to do with what's going on today. We see this aberrant, bizarre, perverse behavior that's being normalized. So we need to talk a little bit about just how that became codified, right? We have actor Liev Schreiber walking around with his transgender kid. I mean, granted, they're going to the Comic-Con festival, I think it was, but, you know, he makes his kid dress up like a circus clown, and you don't even really know what gender the poor kid is. You have Chris Evans, Say It Ain't So, Captain America, Johnny Storm of the Fantastic Four. He's walking around now with his transgender kid. And I talked about this in previous shows. The control exerted by the Kosher Nostra, the tribe, through MCA, through Hollywood, Metro Goldwyn Mayer, this goes back decades now. And the rituals and the trauma and the subversion and the blackmail, so many of these stars, starlets, musical performing artists, etc., are subjected to. They're just like puppets dangling on a string, which is why so many of them go crazy over time. So many of them wind up supposedly dying from pharmaceutical overdose, etc., which is easy enough to believe because so many people in America today, in the Western world, they're pilled up, F you very much, to the pharma industry. And you have this control, this top-down control exerted through the media, through the entertainment industry. And so much of it goes back to this School of Frankfurt, and quite frankly, all the way back there to the days of Babylon, but which I'll get into. And a few other interesting items to note before we move on. You have the guy Kessler. Kessler is the Unite the Right guy. Turns out Jason Kessler, Jason Kessler, the Unite the Right guy, was an Obama supporter. According to a story on Zero Hedge, Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler was reportedly an Obama supporter involved in the Occupy movement as recently as November 2016 before establishing his... I'm sorry. They've been doing pre-forest fire burnings around here, I forget the technical name for it, in California in the past when they tried to burn off brush to prevent like wildfires. They wind up causing wildfires, so they've done that around here, so it's caused the asthma to act up a bit. So when I laugh too hard, I start coughing, so please forgive me. But let me read that again. Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler was reportedly an Obama supporter involved in the Occupy movement as recently as November 2016. Before establishing his white supremacist group, Unity and Security for America, in January 2017. I don't know why I'm laughing. Just the lunacy. It's like you wake up and you might as well be like wrapped up in a loony bin with your head banging up against a friggin' padded cell, you know, wrapped up in a straitjacket, shot full of Thorazine. Think about the final scene in the original Planet of the Apes movie, Charlton Heston, when he sees the Statue of Liberty poking out from the sand, you know, you fools, damn you all to hell. That's how crazy it is, folks. It's like you wake up and you find yourself in this weird, bizarre sci-fi movie. It's like you're watching a movie of yourself on Netflix or something, right? That's how crazy it is, some weird sci-fi movie. Okay, I'll try it one more time. Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler was reportedly an Obama supporter involved in the Occupy movement as recently as November 2016 before establishing his white supremacist group Unity and Security for America in January 2017. It gets crazier, folks, because the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is friggin' tribal Zionist attack dog, for a long time now, just attacking any semblance left of American national sovereignty, of real patriotism, of any kind of freedom left, right? The Southern Poverty Law Center even chimed up. And this is what is quoted on the Zero Hedge article. Per the Southern Poverty Law Center, quote, rumors abound on white nationalist forums that Kessler's ideological pedigree before 2016 was less than pure and seemed to point to involvement in the Occupy movement and past support for President Obama. Oh, wow, that's a great pedigree for a white nationalist, a white supremacist, isn't it? And I just love how the lamestream tribe-controlled media, they reduce everything to a soundbite. Okay, what goes on in Virginia? Oh, it's these white supremacists, it's these white nationalists, right? When they're trucking in loads of these Antifa, Black Lives Matter, all these crisis actors there to start all this trouble, the police stand down, of course, right? You know, these leftists are like spraying silly string at the cops, and the cops are just standing there. Now, normally, cops would look at someone, oh, this person's head is shaped like an assault rifle. I'm in fear for my life, and I'm going to shoot them and kill them, right? Well, no, but on this occasion, as is the case, we've seen this again and again, Berkeley, other places, the police stand down, and they let these leftists run amok. We've seen this shtick before. Back to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Rumors abound on white nationalist forums. They're probably just blogs or internet forums, but they're white nationalist forums, that Kessler's ideological pedigree before 2016 was less than pure and seemed to point to involvement in the Occupy movement and past support for President Obama. Oh, what a racist this guy is. At one recent speech in favor of Charlottesville status as a sanctuary city, Kessler live-streamed himself as an attendee questioned him and apologized for an undisclosed spat during Kessler's apparent involvement with Occupy. Kessler appeared visibly perturbed by the woman's presence and reminders of their past association. I wonder what she was mentioning, you know. Oh, do you remember that time when we were, attacking all these people for being racist, you know? Kessler himself has placed his red pilling around December of 2013 when a PR executive was publicly excoriated for a tasteless Twitter joke about AIDS in Africa. Regarding the incident, Kessler stated, "So it was just a little race joke. Nothing that big of a deal. She didn't have that many followers. She probably didn't think anybody was going to see it." Regardless of Kessler's past politics, the rightward shift in his views was first put on display in November 2016 when his tirade against Wes Bellamy began. Well, so there you have it. And look at this. Here's another interesting thing. Kessler was a CNN assignment editor, Internet sleuths discovered a CNN report on Occupy Wall Street from 5 years ago submitted by CNN assignment editor Jason Kessler. Same guy, These Soros-funded, leftist, brain-dead, Borg, collective Borg-minded troublemakers, Soros-funded, they're doing the exact same thing as previous puppets have done. If you look at Central Asia, if you look at Afghanistan, when the tribe-controlled Taliban was turned loose, right? What do they start doing there? They start destroying all these statues, destroying all these monuments, destroying the heritage of the region, the history of the region. Did the same in Iraq when they turned ISIS loose and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, right? These are, you know, what ziggurats and temples and pyramids were left after all the Allied airstrikes. they turned loose all these ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq types, and they started thrashing all the statues, thrashing all the temples, thrashing all the ziggurats, what was left of them. It's just an eradication of history. And we saw this with the Khmer Rouge, which were turned loose in Cambodia to commit their version of the Red Terror. They wiped out all the intelligentsia. They wiped out any vestige of the traditional peoples there. Thankfully, Angkor Wat somehow survived that whole ordeal. And we see the flip side of that, which is really two sides of the same coin. When the death squads, the so-called right-wing death squads, were turned loose in El Salvador and other places, they went after the intelligentsia. They went after the poets, scholars, the teachers, the engineers, anyone who could have a role in fixing the country instead of, you know, allowing it to become a collectivist dung heap like so many of these Bolshevik collectivist type places have turned into. Anyone who has a potential to fix the place up, engineers, teachers, what have you, they were eradicated, they were expunged, they were eliminated. So whether it was so-called leftists doing this, these hive-minded commies, leftist, socialist, or it was right-wing death squads trained in this, you know, in the School of Americas, their officers, and turned loose by the CIA and the Pentagon and military black ops, the end result is the same, where it's just the heritage, the traditions, the people, the intelligentsia, they're all wiped out. And we're seeing the same thing now in Virginia and other places. And they want to tear down statues of Robert E. Lee and all these other iconic Southern Confederate leaders. And when you look at the sheer numbers involved, folks, the sheer numbers of people slaughtered and made destitute and homeless under the banner of the Admiralty Maritime flag, which the knuckleheads call the U.S. flag, and compare that with all the people that were enslaved, killed, made destitute under the Confederate banner, which is actually the banner of St. Andrew, right? It's not even close, because if you just look at, you know, how many Native Americans were slaughtered, something like 120 million, right? Never mind the colored peoples around the world, the Asians, the Latins, the blacks in Africa, all were slaughtered by the U.S. Maritime Admiralty flag banner. It's not even close, but these simple-minded communist freakazoids that are doing all this stuff in Virginia, Berkeley, everywhere else, none of that matters, right? Because they've been empowered, they fit a psych profile, they're afflicted with this Wetiko hive mind parasite virus, and they've been turned loose. And now even Trump has got to apologize for being white again, talking about racism and how it's got to be stopped, yada, yada, yada. He's just following the lamestream media talking points that this was all the violence in Virginia was sponsored and started by white nationalists, white supremacists. Of course, they're going to sprinkle in, you know, some of these crisis actors and provocateurs. Of course, they're going to wear Nazi outfits. Of course, they're going to wear KKK outfits. And of course, those types are the ones that are going to be featured prominently by the lamestream media. So that's not a surprise. But I was just talking about the Lionsgate portal last week, and all this started right on the heels of the Lionsgate portal closing, basically, and then all this stuff erupts. And I talked last week about how around the time of the Lionsgate portal opening, they do things like drop atomic bombs on Japan and all this other stuff goes on. And all this, you know, we're not even at the eclipse yet. The eclipse is still like 6 days away, so hang on to your hats. And a quick word about the Confederate generals, and I talked about this before, but it bears repeating, I won't spend too much time on it, but most of the soldiers in the ranks in the Confederate armies did not own slaves. And if you lived on a border state, i.e. Tennessee or Virginia, and you heard that Lincoln had called for 75,000 volunteers to augment his standing army to invade the South and by force compel the Confederacy back into the Union, and you knew that these federal armies, were, because you lived in a border state, were going to have to cross through your homeland and harm your family, your loved ones, destroy your property, what little of it you had left, right? Because there was a radical difference between the landed gentry in the South and the soldiers in the ranks. Many of the soldiers in the ranks, they did not have slaves, so they had their own homesteads and farms that they worked, but they were not rich by any means. The reasons for the Civil War and why people fought in the Civil War are two different things. And what would you have done if you lived on a border state like Tennessee and Virginia and you knew these large federal armies were coming down? Whether you believe in slavery or not, by that point, it's, you know, you're overtaken by events. You look at a place like Missouri, which was the site of a lot of guerrilla warfare. There's a good movie with Tobey Maguire on it. I think the guy passed away by now, but it's called Ride with the Devil, and it's a pretty accurate depiction of the vicious guerrilla warfare that occurred in Missouri and Kansas, right? Again, those were border states, and they, you know, the Southerners wanted Kansas to be a slave state, and the Missourians were divided. Many of the Missourians were pro-union, anti-slavery, and some of the Missourians were slave owners and were pro-slavery. But that didn't matter to the federal government armies and to the paramilitaries. Once again, the paramilitaries rear their ugly head. These are people that are empowered by the federal government, armed, sometimes led and trained by them. But basically, these are ruffians, hooligans that, you know, have one cause or another, allegedly. And the paramilitaries were going into Missouri and just wiping out people that they suspected of pro-South sympathies. And when the paramilitaries, and particularly the federal army, meted out punishment in Missouri, it was collective punishment. So if someone shot at a federal soldier, or if a stretch of railroad was sabotaged, everyone along that stretch of railway track, whether they were pro-union or not, and many pro-union, pro-U.S. government civilians were swept up in this. They were executed, they were incarcerated, they were detained, they were tortured, etc., etc. And that movie, Ride with the Devil, with Tobey Maguire, is a pretty good movie that shows this band of Southern guerrillas, right? You know, on horseback, conducting raids and whatnot. But the collective punishment that the feds meted out to the Missourians, you can find good books about this subject, but we're talking total martial law, where if anyone was suspected of any kind of Southern sympathies, they were just rounded up. So many of them were never heard from again. Okay? So this was what was going on even before hostilities started, really, in you know, the official start of the American Civil War, because of all the violence that occurred in Missouri and Kansas. So if you were a Southerner and you lived on a border state like Tennessee and Virginia, or you lived in a place like Georgia, Mississippi, take your pick, and these large federal armies were about to invade, and the federal navy had blockaded all your ports, right? And your livelihood depended upon import and export. This is why there was a lot of Irish in the Southern Confederate armies, because the two main ports of entry for the Irish who were fleeing all the troubles in Ireland, thank you very much, you know, the crown and, you know, the ones controlling the crown in Ireland and England, that led to the deliberate murder and starvation of millions of Irish. And then they had the gall to blame it on like a fungus, you know, the blight, you know, the potato blight, right? When it was quite calculated. You see, the powers that be have always, okay, you guys know me, and you gals know me. I'm no fan of Catholicism, but, and I'll get more into this when I get into the School of Frankfurt stuff, Catholicism has always been a unifying factor. It held families together generationally, multi-generationally, and many nation states had Catholicism as a state religion. So there was an institutionalized aspect to it, where it unified, it held the family unit together, it held the nation state together. To be sure, there was, you know, monarchies, and there was landed aristocracy, and then there were, you know, the poor classes, right? And all this was whipped up into a frenzy, and we've seen the same shtick, okay? They just had different names over times. The tribalist collectivists, the Talmudic types, they created Freemasonry. They created these secret societies that go around, you know, infiltrating everything, usually amongst the upper classes, and causing all these problems. And it gives these firebrands, gives these psychopaths, empowers them to run amok and do all kinds of stuff. These are people that we wouldn't even know who they were or never heard of them had they not been empowered, right? You know, think of people like Machiavelli and people like that who were basically nobodies, but they wrote these treaties and all this other stuff about subversion and all this other stuff. And so we see with the French Revolution, a staunchly Catholic country, but the so-called Jacobins, which were Freemasons, which the Freemason movement, again, was created by the Talmudic types, they created the French Revolution because they had to, like, destroy Catholicism. They had to destroy the monarchy and bring the monarchy, not destroy the monarchy, bring the monarchy to heel. Monarchies, the royal bloodline families of Europe, they're all connected by blood, right? They had to bring them to heel. And so what they did is what they're doing today. They riled up the disenchanted, seemingly disenfranchised lower classes, psych profiled them, and many of the people in the, you know, prior to the French Revolution, they had legitimate grievances. They were tired of the control of the church. They were tired of the control of the monarchy. They were tired of being landless peasants who were being ordered around and still expected to pay tithes, still expected to pay taxes. So they had legitimate grievances, and these grievances and this resentment was was fanned into flames by these provocateurs. So although I despise Catholicism to the very, you know, roots of my being, and this goes back many lifetimes, so when you hear these morons say, oh, the Vatican this, the Vatican that, people like Eric John Phelps, right, who's going around saying Vatican this, Vatican that, Jesuit assassins, yada, 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 no, they're not at the top of the heap, I'm here to tell you. You can believe whatever you want, this is still a free will zone, last I checked, but the very fact that the tribalist collectivists behind the scenes, the Zionist Rothschilds behind the scenes, can whip up the lower masses, the lower classes, rather, and through all these Freemasonic orders, the Jacobins, call them what you will, and then create, you know, the French Revolution and all these other revolutions that swept through France in the mid-19th century, right? And a lot of that, the basis for that was stirring up this long simmering, long-standing resentment against Catholicism. Because again, despite all of its flaws, and I detest Catholicism to the very inner core of my being, for many, Catholicism was a unifying factor. It binded families together. It was a national religion for a lot of nation states, right? And so, as we'll talk about in the School of Frankfurt and going clear back to Babylon days, basically, the idea was to destroy the family unit and destroy anything that tended to bind families together, the nuclear family, and by extension, the nation state, if it was a Catholic country. So I'm just saying all this, you know, as kind of a groundwork, going back and forth and, you know, fast-forwarding to the present and getting back to, you know, Robert E. Lee, right? Robert E. Lee was an outstanding commander during the Mexican War, the illegal U.S. invasion of Mexico, 1847, 1848, which resulted in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is why California, New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, all those places are parts of the U.S. now. They used to be part of, you know, Mexico. Before that, Spain, right? Until the U.S. invaded and then had the gall to blame the Mexicans for invading, right? You know, Mexican territory. Robert E. Lee was one of the heroes of the invading forces, along with another guy named Ulysses S. Grant, right? But Robert E. Lee was on the staff of the commander-in-chief of the American forces invading Mexico, and Robert E. Lee was known for his exploits in the Mexican War. And after the Mexican War, he was a member of the legendary 2nd Cavalry in Texas, where there were a bunch of other people on the 2nd Cavalry in Texas who later achieved fame on both sides of the American Civil War as either a Confederate officer or a Federal officer. People like Jeb Stuart, who became a great cavalry commander during the Civil War under Lee. Ironically, life is just chock full of ironies, folks. When John Brown wanted to start a slave rebellion by raiding the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, arming all these blacks and that were slaves, and then leading this like slave rebellion. And the South was already jittery about slave rebellions. Think about the Nat Turner slave rebellion that happened, sometime before, when Nat Turner led a rebellion of a bunch of slaves, and they slaughtered a bunch of, whites and plantation owners and et cetera, et cetera. So the Southern landed gentry was very understandably skittish about the whole concept of a slave rebellion, right? That's why they didn't allow slaves to read and, learn to read and think for themselves. The great African-American, to use a modern term, abolitionist, Frederick Douglass. He was an orator. He gave a lot of speeches. African-American guy. And he actually was friends with John Brown. Frederick Douglass said something to the effect that a slave is first shackled in his mind before he is shackled in his body. Such a profound statement there, right? A slave is first shackled in his mind before he's shackled in his body. Just look what the lamestream media is doing, and just look at the dumbing down Common Core, the gender teachings in school today, et cetera, et cetera. So Robert E. Lee and his subordinate, Jeb Stuart, James Ewell Brown Stuart, they were tasked by Washington, by the War Department, to quell this rebellion by John Brown, right? He and his forces, his sons and some blacks they'd recruited, had raided the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry and were trying to get some weapons and arm all these blacks, right, and incite this rebellion, which they hoped would spread out throughout the South. And of all people, the War Department had tasked Colonel Robert E. Lee, late of the 2nd Cavalry of Texas, late of his heroism exhibited in the American invasion of Mexico. And Jeb Stuart was a subordinate, and Robert E. Lee, along with a contingent of Marines, if memory serves, from the Washington Navy Yard, they went to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and stopped this rebellion in its tracks. John Brown was eventually hanged for treason, ironically, right? Treason to the federal government. He then became a martyr for the North when, the North invaded the South. And Robert E. Lee was the best officer in the federal army at the time of secession. Remember that Ulysses S. Grant was not back in the army by then. He'd left the army in disgrace some years before. And I think he was working in his father's store in Galena, Illinois, Ulysses S. Grant. Whereas Robert E. Lee, right, he became, among other accomplishments, he was a superintendent at West Point. Robert E. Lee's father was Light Horse Harry Lee, who was George Washington's cavalry commander during the Revolutionary War. His father, Light Horse Harry Lee, was a hero in the American Revolutionary War against the British Crown. Everyone talks about Arlington Cemetery. Well, I'll tell you how Arlington Cemetery became a national cemetery. Arlington was the ancestral home of Robert E. Lee's wife, Mary Custis. Mary Custis was a descendant of George Washington, right? And their family estate was Arlington. And so when the federal armies moved in, they took over Arlington, and out of sheer spitefulness, they turned the Lee Custis family estate at Arlington into a national cemetery. And there are no Confederate soldiers buried in Arlington Cemetery, which used to be the Robert E. Lee family home. The idea being that no quote-unquote traitors, unquote, should be buried, interned at Arlington National Cemetery. That's not to say that there has never been traitors buried at Arlington National Cemetery. I could think of a lot of them. General George C. Marshall, the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Arch Rockefeller flunky and traitor, who was definitely 100% involved in the whole Pearl Harbor scam and was responsible for, in large part, helping Mao win mainland China over Chiang Kai-shek. There's been a number of other traitors buried there, but, you know, side issue, as AJ would say. And Lee was in a quandary. The Federal Army, which he served faithfully for decades, was going to invade his home state of Virginia. What would you do? Lee had to look at it from the standpoint of, you know, he's a patrician. He has family and friends and loved ones. This Federal Army, and he knew many of the officers personally in the Federal Army that still stayed with the Federal Army. He knew how good they were. He knew the resources. He knew about the Anaconda plan to blockade the southern ports with the Federal Navy. He knew about the vast resources that the North could bring to bear. And he didn't want to see his kinfolk slaughtered, so he did what his conscience demanded. He resigned his commission, and he volunteered to serve with the Confederate Army, like many people did. Okay, how many people know that one of the outstanding federal generals, General George Thomas, he's got a statue in Virginia as well? And for a long time, the Virginians didn't want to put a statue of General George Thomas. Why? Because General George Thomas was a Virginian who stayed loyal to the federal government. And he later commanded the Army of the Cumberland. And he played a key role in the federal victory at Missionary Ridge, which was an important battle in Tennessee, if memory serves. So, you know, no one's, I don't know if they're going to tear down General George Thomas's statue. You know, he was a federal hero who for decades, his name was reviled in the South for being a traitor, right? But it just shows you how much of history has been eradicated and how little the people in the South today know, especially the influx of all these Antifa, the influx of all these Black Lives Matter, the influx of all these crazed social justice warriors. Essentially, the only difference I would say, the ringleaders are always going to be, you know, tribalist collectivists, always. That's just the way the pattern has been. I mean, when you look at the Bolshevik Red Terror, the hundreds of millions, right? Conservatively, 66 million were wiped out, mostly Christians, I might add, again, because, you know, Christianity, the family unit, the nation state, it binds everybody, you know, despite whatever class these people may be in Eurasia, in former Tsarist Russia. You know, there were still Russians. There were still Christian Russians. They still had an allegiance to the family and, by extension, to the monarchy, right? Which the Tsar Nicholas was really descended from Germans, but his family had lived there for a long, long time by then. They were as Russian can be. And what happened? This mass influx of tribe members from places like New York and Brooklyn and all over Europe, they go over there into Russia and just start massacring everybody left, right, and center. Think of what Bill Ayers, the weatherman guy, said. Oh, at least 2 million Americans are going to be slaughtered. He just said it just, you know, casually, just, you know, ho-hum, no big deal. There was an FBI agent present at a secret meeting of the weathermen when William Ayers, Bill Ayers, was talking about, like, blowing up, you know, the Pentagon. But even with an FBI agent in their midst who witnessed and heard William Ayers say this, nothing happened to William Ayers. Why? Because he was a protected species. That's why. Like so many of these provocateurs, it's like they can just get away with anything, right? The Southern Poverty Law Center, we just spoke of earlier, they were directly involved with Elohim City. That was that that religious kind of pseudo-white nationalist place in Oklahoma that were training people, you know, to one day rise up and fight against the federal government, directly connected what happened in Oklahoma City. Yeah, this Southern Poverty Law Center was connected to that, of course, right? They were being trained by a German mercenary in military tactics, the people in Elohim City. Guy who was brought in on a special visa, if memory serves, by somebody in the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the Pentagon's in-house all-arms, all-service intelligence agency. Don't quote me on that. It's been a while since I read about Oklahoma City and the inner nuances of it. But there's no doubt that someone within the Pentagon had brought or provided a visa for this German mercenary to come over and start training these Elohim City types. And so what we have here with this influx of all these Antifa types and all these Black Lives Matter types, all these crisis actors, all these social justice warriors, they're just moving them around. They're bussing them in. They're flying them in. And they're being rallied by these, you know, tribalist collectivists. And then you have this oppo same in the form of Jason Kessler, right? Unite the Right. Well, not too long ago, he was an Obama supporter, right? But it's the same dynamic. You're bringing in all these people that have nothing to do with the South, nothing to do with Virginia, right? You have this guy, his last name was Doan, D-O-A-N. It's that Southeast Asian. I can't remember if it's Laotian or what. But he's screaming about how, oh, this, you know, this statue of this Confederate general, it just, you know, leaves me frustrated and leaves me angry. Well, then don't look at it. Stop being offended by everything, you weakling, right? And so they're bringing them in. It's just a mass influx. And to round out this part of the discussion about Robert E. Lee did what his conscience demanded of him. He resigned his commission to protect his family. The proof is in the pudding. The benefit of hindsight and all that, hindsight being 2020, look what the federal armies did to the South. Part of Lee's motivation for his two invasions of the North, in which a lot of people have been critical of, right? A lot of people said he should have stayed on the strategic defensive and bled the federal armies who were just commanded by just a series of incompetents until Ulysses S. Grant went over to personally take command of the Army of the Potomac under the figurehead General Meade. Meade was a mediocrity. Meade was the victor at Gettysburg, but you know he didn't pursue Lee afterwards, which we should have done. Lee invaded the North twice. He invaded Maryland, which resulted in the Battle of Sharpsburg, known in the North as the Battle of Antietam, the single bloodiest day of the American Civil War, something like 24,000 casualties on both sides, combined Confederate and federal soldiers, right? In a single day, that was the Battle of Sharpsburg. And in utter defiance of McClellan, the federal commander, Lee just stayed put for a few days. And then decided to withdraw, and McClellan did not pursue him vigorously as he should have. About a year later, a little less than a year later, Lee once again invades the North, this time culminating in the Battle of Gettysburg, which Lon Strickler and I talked about. If you study that battle, very strange, and now it's, you know, I've learned from Lon and others that, you know, Pennsylvania is just one big vortex area, all kinds of cryptids running amok and everything. And no wonder after, you know, that horrific battle there, 3-day battle at Gettysburg, people are still seeing ghosts. People are still having weird anomalous phenomena, you know, going through a lot of weird stuff there at the Gettysburg battlefield. But Lee's rationale for invading the North twice, which he's been heavily criticized for, is that he had to take the fight away from Virginia because Virginia had been a battleground and he didn't have any food to sustain his troops, right? He didn't have, and also he felt that if they kept fighting in Virginia, the citizens of Virginia would suffer disproportionately because it was their homes, it was their fields, it was their property, it was their lives that were, you know, being consumed by these wars. So, and also the nature of Lee, you have to understand, he was an offensive-minded general. Always wanted to attack, always wanted to fight, right? So the proof was in the pudding. The federal armies, like, ravaged the South from one end to the other. And not just Sherman's march through Georgia and the Carolinas. South Carolina was particularly hammered and particularly destroyed. There was Sheridan's campaign in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. There was the campaigns in what was known as the Trans-Mississippi Department in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. The whole areas were just basically made uninhabitable, okay? They were just destroyed, just thrashed by the federal armies. The plantations, the homes, the dwellings burned to the ground. The foodstuffs, the means to sustain themselves was taken away from the southern citizens. And then on top of that, as if that wasn't bad enough, okay, because remember, the males of fighting age for the Confederate armies, for the Southern armies, they're away fighting the wars. They're getting killed, they're getting captured, etc. The women, the old folks, the children are left at home. And here come the federal armies. Not many people realize it, but there was actually almost a succession within the succession. The governors of Georgia and Tennessee were threatening to secede from the Confederacy, which at that point, the Confederate capital was in Richmond, Virginia. And the governors of Georgia and Tennessee were saying, our troops are all over there in Virginia. And meanwhile, there's all these federal armies rampaging through Georgia and Tennessee. We don't see many, in fact, any Virginia regiments and soldiers over here. But you have a bunch of our Georgia, Tennessee, Mississippi regiments, Alabama residents over there in Virginia. You know what? We're going to succeed. We're going to succeed, and we're going to make an alliance with the border states like Kentucky and places that we've had trade and commerce with all along before this war came about, right? I mean, not many people realize that. There was almost a succession within a succession. You know, that's another story. The point of relevance is citizens, the civilians, the women, the children, the old folks, the infirm, they were left high and dry. The federal armies came, and many of them not only foraged off the land, but they destroyed it in the process. So they would take what food the citizens had, the women and the children, and left them with nothing, and burned down their houses and dwellings and farms in the process. So here comes the harsh winter, and they're left exposed to the elements, and many of them died. We're talking, if you consider all the civilians that died in the South, we're talking millions, folks. And this has always been underplayed by these establishment historians, and that wasn't even enough. In the wake of the Confederate surrender, here come all these so-called carpetbaggers from the North. And who were the carpetbaggers? Well, They were members of the tribe, the tribalist collectivists that bought up all this property, you know, what they couldn't just steal outright that was still worth buying, they bought for pennies on the dollar. And who were these destitute, starving, emaciated, impoverished women, children, old folks that were left? What could they do about it? Nothing. So the northern carpetbaggers come in, these financiers, they come in, they buy up everything in the lot next door. That's how the game is played, right? So was Robert E. Lee and all the others fighting in the South, were they wrong, right, for what happened? Slavery was going to die a natural death, eventually. The powers that be, the tribalist collectivists, use the issue of slavery as a means to destroy the country. That's what it was all about. Slavery was going to die a natural death. There was no way the South was going to sustain itself by staying an agrarian economy. You basically had two different countries, or three, if you count the commerce going on between the border states and Kentucky, using all those middle of the country river waterways, where they conducted trade and commerce together, had their own distinct economy long before the American Civil War, a thriving economy. But, you know, the powers that be, they wanted to destroy America. They wanted to split it in two. And so, as we've seen over and over and over again, and General Ulysses S. Grant and General Sherman in the Mississippi campaign, they tried to put a stop to this. They were arresting and throwing out, members of the tribe. You go read the correspondence. Go read the orders they put out. They were naming them specifically. That they were causing trouble. They were going in. They were speculating in cotton. Cotton was supposed to be an embargoed item. It was supposed to be an embargoed goods, right? Pardon the poor English. But anyway, just go read the comments that General Ulysses S. Grant and General Sherman, amongst others, said about the tribalist collectivists. But the point of relevance is, you know what? Lee and all them, after what had happened to the South, how it was destroyed, literally burned from one end to another, biological warfare was perpetrated by the Federal Navy upon the citizens of Galveston, Texas. The same way the federal government utilized smallpox and other biological pathogens against the Native Americans, right? So who was wrong here, ultimately? Was the South wrong for standing up because they knew that their way of life was going to be turned upside down and destroyed? When slavery, and a lot of people, a lot of wise people in the South knew slavery was in its death throes. Slavery was on its way out. It was only a matter of time. The South could not have sustained itself with a purely agrarian economy that was reliant upon slavery. And who brought the slaves in anyway in the first place? The tribalist collectivists did, of course. So, let's put things in proper perspective here. Oh, one more thing before I talk about the School of Frankfurt. And I think this is comical, and if it wasn't so serious, maybe I'd laugh more about it. But the USS Nimitz, a nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed supercarrier, sent out this frantic message: we're being spied on by an Iranian drone. We're so terrified. Gee, I wonder where they got this victim-aggressor mindset from, right? So this Iranian drone flies over or near the USS Nimitz, a supercarrier loaded down with nuclear weapons, and the U.S. Navy is freaking out. Oh, a drone. For all we know, an Iranian teenager high on hash could be flying that drone. Right? And what's going on? The U.S. Navy is freaking out. Oh, a drone. If you don't like it, if it scares you so much, why don't you just shoot it down? Right? And stop bitching about it. Stop playing the victim aggressor. Oh, North Vietnamese patrol boats attacking our big, powerful Navy. A drone, an Iranian drone being flown by a teenager. We're so scared. It's that victim aggressor mentality, which is they've imbued into American police officers. Right? And now it seems that, the U.S. Navy is going through the same shtick. Oh, we're so scared. We're so scared of a drone. We'll shoot it down then and shut up about it already, for crying out loud. Man up, Okay, let me read you some excerpts from an article on an outstanding website called darkmoon.me, darkmoon.michael echo, and the article is called "Satan's Secret Agents, the Frankfurt School and Their Evil Agenda." And it's based on an original article by Timothy Matthews, abbreviated and adapted with additional material by Lasha Darkmoon. Lasha Darkmoon is one of my favorite investigators, authors. She's a scholar. She's an academic. And she doesn't give interviews. She doesn't really let anyone know what her identity is, but she's done fantastic work. Once again, www.darkmoon.me. And let me read you some of the article, parts of the article, and then I will comment on it. Here it goes. Satan's secret agents, the Frankfurt School, and their evil agenda. Let's begin by considering the corrosive work of the Frankfurt School, a group of German-American scholars, mostly Jewish, who developed highly provocative and original perspectives on contemporary society and culture, drawing on Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche, Freud, and Weber. Their idea of a, quote, cultural revolution, unquote, was not particularly new. Joseph, Comte de Maistre, 1753 to 1821, who for 15 years had been a Freemason, had this to say: until now, nations were killed by conquest, that is, by invasion. But here an important question arises: can a nation not die on its own soil without resettlement or invasion, by allowing the flies of decomposition to corrupt to the very core those original and constituent principles which make it what it is? End quote. What was the Frankfurt School? I'm reading from the article. Well, in the days following the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, it was believed that a workers' revolution would sweep into Europe and eventually into the United States. It failed to do so. Towards the end of 1922, the Communist International, Comintern, began to consider the reasons for this failure. What went wrong? On Lenin's initiative, a meeting was organized at the Marx-Engels Institute in Moscow. The aim of the meeting was to throw light on the meaning of Marx's cultural revolution. What did, quote, cultural revolution, unquote, entail? What was it all about? First, among those present was George Lukács, a Jewish-Hungarian aristocrat and son of a banker. He had become a communist during World War I. A good Marxist theoretician, he had developed the idea of, quote, revolution and eros, unquote, sexual instinct used as an instrument of destruction. Then there was Willy Munzenberg, another revolutionary Jew whose proposed solution to the problems besetting society was to, quote, to organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Stink, as in smell very bad. Only then, after they have corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat, unquote, which basically in practice means slaughtering everybody that, you know, they don't want around. Continuing with the article, it was, said Ralph de Toledano, and if you can find one of Ralph de Toledano's books about spies, dupes, diplomats, I forget the exact title, it's an outstanding book about the communist infiltration of Western society, Western governments, the U.S. government. He was an outstanding author. It was, said Ralph de Toledano, 1916-2007, is when he passed away, the conservative author and co-founder of the National Review, quote, a meeting more harmful to Western civilization than the Bolshevik Revolution itself, unquote. So this meeting where George Lukács talked about using sexual instinct used as an instrument of destruction, and where Willy Munzenberg, who we'll hear more about in a moment, another revolutionary Jew, said they had to organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Only then, after they have corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat, unquote. So here comes Ralph de Toledano, an outstanding researcher who knew all about the tribalist, collectivist, communist agenda. It was a meeting more harmful to Western civilization than the Bolshevik Revolution itself, said Ralph de Toledano. That's a profound statement. This school, designed to put flesh on their revolutionary program, was started at the University of Frankfurt in the Institute für Social Forschung. To begin with, school and institute were indistinguishable. In 1923, the institute had been officially established and funded by Felix Weil, born 1898, died 1975. Weil, born in Argentina into a wealthy Jewish family, was sent to attend school in Germany at the age of 9. He attended the universities in Tübingen and Frankfurt, where he graduated with a doctoral degree in political science. While at these universities, he became increasingly interested in socialism and Marxism. Karl Grunberg, the Institute's Jewish director from 1923 to 1929, was an avowed Marxist, although the Institute did not have any official party affiliations. But in 1930, Max Horkheimer, also Jewish, assumed control. He believed that Marxist theory should be the basis of the Institute's research. When Hitler came to power, the Institute was closed, and its members... and its members by various routes fled to the United States and ended up as academics at major U.S. universities, Columbia, Princeton, Brandeis, and California at Berkeley. Go figure. And then here's a comment by Lasha Darkman. The fact that they spoke very poor English was no disqualification. They were Jewish, and so they managed to obtain prestigious academic appointments through Jewish influence, i.e. through networking, a system that works exceptionally well even today and which accounts for the huge and unfair preponderance of Jews in academia. This is what we're seeing played out, and this whole mindset of perversion, filth, and scumbaggery, as Vinnie Eastwood would call it, was codified in this school of Frankfurt, this Frankfurt school. To undermine Western civilization, I'm continuing with the article, the Frankfurt School Jews called for the most negative and destructive criticism possible of every sphere of life. To destabilize society and bring it to its knees, to engineer collapse, to produce crisis and catastrophe, this became the aim of these maladjusted and mentally sick Jewish revolutionaries masquerading as high-powered intellectuals. And we see these types all over the place today, and especially also amongst the brainwashed goyim, right? But they're kind of marginalized. The recently empowered minority, so-called blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, etc., they've been afflicted by this virus as well. Their policies, they hope, would spread like a virus, quote, continuing the work of the Western Marxists by other means, unquote, as one of their members noted. To further the advance of their quiet cultural revolution, the Frankfurt School made the following 12 recommendations. This is key, folks. Pay attention. All of them calculated to undermine the foundations of society and create the dystopia we now see all around us. 1. The creation of racism offenses and hate speech laws. Key, very key point. We saw this first playing out in the UK, and then it spread out to the rest of the Western world. 1, the creation of racism offenses and hate speech laws. 2, continual change to create confusion. Example, in the school curricula. Now we have Common Core. Now we have, you know, teachings on like gender and all this other stuff. 3, masturbation propaganda in schools, combined with the homosexualization of children and the corruption by exposing them to child porn in the classroom. This is one of the brilliant ideas they come up with. Now, who could even think of this stuff, right? It's like, from what nether dimension are they downloading or uploading this stuff from, right? Who could even think of this stuff? 3, masturbation propaganda in schools combined with the homosexualization of children and their corruption by exposing them to child porn in the classroom. 4, the systematic undermining of parental and teachers' authority. Thus far, check, 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 check. We've seen all of those. The systematic undermining of parental and teachers' authority. 5, huge immigration to destroy national identity and foment future race wars. Check. Okay, check, 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 check. Charlottesville, Virginia. Like immigrant rape invasion throughout Europe and the U.S. and everywhere else. The systematic undermining of parental and teachers' authority. Check. Huge immigration to destroy national identity and foment future race wars. Check. 6, the systematic promotion of excessive drinking and recreational drugs. Double check. Importation of drugs by the intelligence community in alliance with organized crime elements under the control of the Kosher Nostra, etc., etc. 7, the systematic promotion of sexual deviance in society. Check. 8, an unreliable legal system with bias against the victims of crime. That's hardcore, but it's we're seeing this play out. Okay, 8, an unreliable legal system with bias against the victims of crime. That Australian woman that was gunned down by a Somali in the guise of a policeman, right? Oh, how dare you come out of your house wearing your pajamas? You know, I'm disgusted by the sight of you, and he guns her down, right? 9, dependency on state benefits, check, right? And that's what they're doing. This influx of immigrants, they're giving them cell phones, they're giving them tablets, they're giving them, putting them on welfare. 10, control and dumbing down of media. Control and dumbing down of media, check. 11, encouraging the breakdown of the family, check. 12, all-out attack on Christianity and the emptying of churches. Well, basically, I would add to that that the only churches that will be left will be satanic in nature, right? An all-out attack on Christianity. And understand, folks, the unifying, rallying effect that Christianity had in pre-Bolshevik invasion Russia, for example, right? And look what happened there with the influx of all the Bolsheviks, where they just wiped out anyone who was a Christian or people they thought were Christians. And, you know, again, I'm not pro-Catholicism. I despise Catholicism. They're overrun by a bunch of pedophiles. And, of course, the Russians had their own version of Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity. But it just goes to show you that the tribalist collectivists, they're the ones in charge of the churches, you know, with their 501c tax-exempt program, basically makes the churches under the thumb. If they want to retain their tax-exempt status, they better do. They better preach what they're told to preach, right? And here's another comment by Lasha Darkmoon. In the Soviet Union, under Stalin and his communist Jews, the emptying of churches was accomplished by the simple expedient of burning the churches down, thousands of them. And she writes, see here, 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 here. These are links for more details on the systematic destruction of Christian churches and the persecution of Russian Christians under the Jewish leaders of the Russian Revolution. Coincidentally, she goes on, most of the 12 aims and objectives mentioned above were set out prominently in the pages of that alleged forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The Jewish philosophers of the Frankfurt School, it seems, had been heavily influenced by the protocols. Go figure, right? They were clearly impressed by what they read there and decided to implement its recommendations in their own sinister agenda. If we're to believe establishment historians like Christopher Andrews, right? Christopher Andrew Andrews, I forget what his surname is. He wrote a bunch of books about British intelligence, and then he morphed into this expert who all-knowing, all-wise about Soviet-era intelligence. And he stated in his books that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a forgery created by the Tsar's intelligence arm, intelligence agency, the Okhrana. Well, maybe, maybe not. But why is it that these Frankfurt School types, they take on lock, stock, and barrel the tenets of this forgery by the Tsar's intelligence agency, the Okhrana? That doesn't even make sense. But I never took Christopher Andrew or Andrews, whatever his last name is, seriously anyway. Okay, continuing with Lasha Darkmoon's analysis, one of the main ideas of the Frankfurt School was to exploit Freud's idea of, quote, pansexualism, unquote. The search for indiscriminate sexual pleasure. The promotion of, quote, unisex, unquote. The blurring of distinctions between the sexes. Check, double check, trickle, triple check. 57 checks for all the different genders. The overthrowing of traditional relationships between men and women, and finally the undermining of heterosexuality at the expense of homosexuality, as for example in the idea of same-sex marriage. And folks, same-sex marriage is a slippery slope, because you're already seeing these same-sex marriages, they're just in attack dog mode. They're attacking anybody who stands in the way of same-sex marriages being made legal in all these different countries. And do you think that if they get what they want with same-sex marriage, that they're going to stop right there? Do you think that they say, okay, we got what we wanted, then, you know, we'll just back off now? No. They're attacking anyone using the old tribalist collectivist stunt of trying to get people fired from their jobs, of getting businesses boycotted and, you know, sanctions, you know, put on, you know, businesses and what have you, boycotts. And they're just going after anybody who stands in the way of same-sex marriages. And they're being allowed to get away with it. And you look what the Antifa types are doing in Charlottesburg, in Charlottesville, I forget the name of it, in Virginia. I mean, they're hurling feces and they're hurling urine at people. That's biological warfare, folks. That's the kind of hive mind parasite virus mentality, the Wetico mentality, the gutter board collective mentality we're talking about. So if you think the same-sex marriage types will be happy that once they get their same-sex marriage legalized and they'll back off and they'll just, you know, live happily ever after, no way. That's not how they roll. They're going to keep pushing. And anyone who gets in their way, they're just going to unleash on them. And nothing's going to happen to them. Because as one of the tenets of this Frankfurt School is, it's an unjust system that has an unjust legal system with a bias against the victims of crime. Against the victims of crime, okay? So keep that point in mind. People say, oh, same-sex marriage, who cares about it? No. It's way more than that. It's like, you give them an inch, they want your whole body. You give them your fingernail, they want a mile, right? I'm getting my cliches all mixed up. Okay, continuing with the article, Willie Munzenberg summed up the Frankfurt School's long-term operation thus, quote, "We will make the West so corrupt that it stinks," unquote. To continue, "We must organize the intellectuals and use them to make Western civilization stink. Only then, after they have corrupted all its values and made life impossible, can we impose the dictatorship of the proletariat." And Lasha Darkmoon comments again. According to Sean McMeekins' The Red Millionaire, a political biography of Willie Munzenberg, Munzenberg was, quote, "the perpetrator of some of the most colossal lies of the modern age. He helped unleash a plague of moral blindness upon the world from which we have still not recovered," unquote. Continuing with the article, the Frankfurt School believed there were two types of revolution, A, political revolution, and B, cultural revolution. They were more concerned with cultural revolution, the demolition of the established order from within. Quote, "Modern forms of subjection are marked by mildness," they taught, right? As if just wiping everybody out in the red terror in the most obscene ways, it was too mild. So-called reforms, unquote, quote unquote, were to be made so slowly and subtly that these changes for the worse were barely susceptible. The school saw the undermining of the social order as a long-term project. Again, Lasha Darkmoon commenting. Now, the systematic erosion of Christian moral values and the promotion of sexual perversion is known as cultural Marxism. Today, thanks to the efforts of organized Jewry, which controls 96% of the world's media, cultural Marxism has largely triumphed and Christianity lies in ruins. To many dispassionate observers, society has now reached its rock-bottom moral nadir. Yeah, like Captain America, Chris Evans promoting transgenderism amongst kids. And look what's happened also. Huffington Post. "You are not alone," the headline reads. "Celebs stand up for trans kids after White House drops civil rights protections." We were just talking about that, right? Here's the article, just to digress for a second to this headline. "They're standing up and speaking out. Celebrities voiced their support for transgender children on Wednesday after President Donald Trump's administration said it would no longer protect them from discrimination at school." It was just a comment that was absolutely guaranteed to inflame the passions of these freak show types, right? And here's all these people taking to Twitter. Nia Vardalos, alleged celebrity, "Never heard of you. I love and support you. You are not alone. Hashtag protect trans kids." Oh, Chris Evans, Captain America, Johnny Storm from the Fantastic Four. Say it ain't so. He's the one that's walking around parading his transgender kid, right? And talk about child abuse. "To the LGBTQ community, I'm sorry for the message that was sent today. They don't speak for all of us. We love you." And keep dancing on the strings, right? You know, puppet that you are. Katy Perry, Monarch Girl. trans friend, if you are struggling tonight, please reach out to, you know, and then she puts these addresses or something that people can go to online. Equality for All, Katy Perry, Monarch Girl. Josh Groban, alleged celebrity, never heard of you. Trans community, you are not alone. We stand with you and support you, and there is help. Of course, there's Ellen DeGeneres. There's all these other people that I haven't heard of. There's alleged celebrities, right? A whole slew of them, actually. And so that's what we have here, folks. It's a complete inversion, a destruction of the family unit as a precursor to destruction of the nation state. The next step is just complete authoritarian collectivist rule. Remember what Bill Ayers said, a minimum of 2 million Americans will die, etc., etc. And I talked about how Hollywood has had these puppets on a string going back to the days of Musical Corporation of America, all the way to the golden age, you know, the beginning, so-called, of, you know, Hollywood, you know, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, all that, right? Let me get back to the article, because the systematic erosion of Christian moral values and the promotion of sexual perversion is known as cultural Marxism. Today, thanks to the efforts of organized Jewry, which controls 96% of the world's media, cultural Marxism has largely triumphed and Christianity lies in ruins. To many dispassionate observers, society has now reached its rock-bottom moral nadir, as Jewish Marxists such as William Munzenberg would have been only too happy to witness had he been around today. These iconoclasts kept their sights firmly fixed on the family, education, media, sex, and popular culture. Each of these would be their target. If things did not go from bad to worse year after year, they were not succeeding. To these revolutionary Jewish thinkers, bad was good and worse was better. And the article goes on to say, the destruction of the family and the promotion of feminism. And if you get a chance, go watch the video by the former KGB subversion psychological warfare expert, and he was interviewed by Edward Griffin, W. Edward Griffin, the guy that wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island. This is a long time ago, in the 90s, I think, or the 80s, he was interviewed, this former KGB spy was interviewed, and he talked about how they work in 15-year generations. They know that if they manipulate society, education, everything, they can completely change the psychology, the orientation of American society inside out in increments of 15 years, and boy howdy have they done that. And he talks about feminism too, incidentally, this former KGB guy. In the article it goes, the destruction of the family and the promotion of feminism, and the KGB guy talked about feminism. The school's critical theory preached that, quote, the authoritarian personality, unquote, was a product of the patriarch or family, an idea directly linked to Engels' Origins of the Family, Private Property, and the State, which promoted matriarchy. Yeah, right. Already Karl Marx had written in the Communist Manifesto about the radical notion of a community of women. In the German Ideology, 1845, he had written disparagingly about the idea of the family as the basic unit of society. This was one of the basic tenets of the critical theory, the need to break down the family unit. And then Lasha Darkman goes on to say, all families were essentially evil, these thinkers believed, even happy families, so they had to be destroyed. It was better if children had no parents or did not know who their parents were, or if they were orphans of the state. It was better if romantic love between the sexes leading to stable long-term marriages were destroyed in favor of short-term, unstable, promiscuous relationships. After all, the former might lead to happiness for all concerned, and that was clearly impermissible, for the whole point of the Cultural Revolution was, quote, to create a culture of pessimism, quote, that's Lukacs, the guy I quoted from above, and to make life impossible for everyone, Munzenberg, George Lukacs. 1885 to 1971. I want a culture of pessimism, a world abandoned by God. Lasha Darkmoon again. These neo-Freudian Marxist philosophers of the Frankfurt School were clearly out to create trouble, to drive a wedge between parent and child, and sow division in the family. Whatever was good in human relationships simply had to be destroyed. If people didn't have problems, then problems would have to be manufactured, quote, to make life impossible, unquote. All this prepared the way for the warfare against the masculine gender promoted by Marcuse under the guise of, quote, women's liberation, unquote. And now you see all these transgender kids, right? Oh, you're not a boy, you're a girl. You're whatever, you know, you want to be or what we want you to be. All this prepared the way for the warfare against the masculine gender promoted by Mark Cuse under the guise of women's liberation and by the New Left movement in the 1960s. They proposed transforming our culture into a female-dominated one. But it's not the divine feminine, though, right? My comments here. It's the wounded divine feminine, the severely distorted divine feminine. It's not even really the divine feminine. It's this Wetico hive mind parasite virus Borg collective feminine hate males, etc., etc., that we see today, where you have all these radical feminists going around claiming to be victims, and you know they're not saying anything about all these raping immigrants that are just invading all these countries. No, they got nothing to say about them, but they got everything to say about the established order, if you want to call it that, the normal way of things. They've got a beef against that. Lasha Darkmoon comments, the idea that women should run society and wear the trousers telling men what to do had an enormous appeal to certain bossy types of women with a surplus of testosterone, particularly to butch lesbians and man-hating matriarchs. Many of these misguided females were to become evangelists for radical feminism, some even proposing to cut themselves off from the male sex completely and live in communes of their own. Curiously enough, the number of Jewish feminists is huge, out of all proportion to their percentage in the population. In 1933, Wilhelm Reich, an honored and adulated member of the Frankfurt School, wrote in The Mass Psychology of Fascism that matriarchy was the only genuine family type of natural society. Again, it's not real divine feminine, that's a thing. He was, as such, to be an inspiration to the feminists. And Lasha Darkmoon again. Reich, incidentally, a compulsive masturbator and sexual pervert, had entertained incestuous longings for his own mother and practiced bestiality with horses while still a child. This versatile sexual deviant, now a cult figure on the left, along with the equally sex-obsessed Herbert Marcuse, popularizer of the slogan Make Love, Not War, were to be godfathers of the sexual revolution of the 1960s, as well as the patron saints of the feminist movement. And another part of this article, the indoctrination of children through education. Bertrand Russell was to join the Frankfurt School in their efforts at mass social engineering. He spilled the beans in his 1951 book, The Impact of Science on Society. He wrote, quote, the social psychologists of the future will have a number of classes of school children on whom they will try different methods of producing an unshakable conviction that snow is black. Various results will soon be arrived at. First, that the influence of home is obstructive, and we see this in the media in Hollywood all the time. Second, that not much can be done unless indoctrination begins before the age of 10. Third, that verses set to music and repeatedly intoned are very effective. Fourth, that the opinion that snow is white must be held to show a morbid taste eccentricity. But I anticipate it is for future scientists to make these maxims precise and discover exactly how much it costs per head to make children believe that snow is black and how much less it would cost to make them believe it is dark gray. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. And then Lasha Darkmoon comments, the irony is unmistakable, but that is beside the point. Russell was all for turning the world upside down and ushering in brave new world. Atheism, feminism, sexual liberation, i.e. the green light to promiscuity, perversion, and abortion on demand. The devaluation of values so sought after by the luminaries of the Frankfurt School has now largely been achieved through sex education and media propaganda. Teen Vogue, Mios Dios, right? Teen Vogue has just gone crazy with all of their, you know, freakish ideas to children these days. In particular by the promotion of masturbation, pornography, and the systematic high-pressure salesmanship of homosexuality in schools. End note by Lasha Darkmoon. 15 years after, and she quotes American historian Edward Schoonmaker, 15 years after the Bolshevik Revolution was launched to carry out the Marxist program, the editor of the American Hebrew could write, quote, according to such information that the writer could secure while in Russia a few weeks ago, not one Jewish synagogue has been torn down, as have hundreds, perhaps thousands of the Greek Catholic churches in Moscow and other large cities. One can see Christian churches in the process of destruction. The government needs the location for a large building, etc., etc. Well, again, we see this played out with ziggurats in Iraq, with Buddhist temples, Buddhist shrines, with Sufi places of worship in Central Asia, all being thrashed by those afflicted with a hive mind parasite virus that are ultimately under control of this dark force that we've been talking about. Now stop and think about it, what they've been saying about the family. Okay, I'll create a word picture for you, right? And that's all I'll do now, you know, as far as reading that article. You can find it for yourself, darkmoon.me. Imagine you're looking across the street and you see the classic American nuclear family. You see the father, let's call him Ward, okay? He's out there mowing the lawn. He's wearing a nicely tailored business suit. And you see his wife, you know, in the kitchen. You can see her through the window. She's washing the dishes. She's wearing her pearls and she's wearing her elegant evening dress. Oh, there's their eldest son, Wallace. They call him Wally. He's there with his girlfriend, Mary Ellen Rogers. And then you see their youngest boy, Theodore. They call him, like, the Beaver, right? And so you have this nuclear American family right out of, like, Americana in the 1950s and 60s. Ward, June, Wally, and the Beaver, right? Now, if Willie Munzenberg has his way, this is what will happen to the family that we're talking about, the Cleavers in our example. Ward will turn into an alcoholic and will be systematically beating up his wife, June. And when he's not beating up his wife, June, Ward will be going off to not just the strip clubs, but he'll also be going to these places where he can be beaten up by, like, a dominatrix. June, in our example, will retreat into a downward spiral of pharmaceutical pill addiction, alcoholism, and she will carry on multiple out-of-marriage affairs. Wally will get into friggin' wife-swapping with his partner, Mary Ellen Rogers, and eventually ditch her after she becomes pregnant and demands that she get an abortion. And then in our example, the beaver, can't forget about the beef, right? Well, the beaver is going to turn into a transgender kid. He's going to turn into a transgender kid, and he's going to wind up teaching at an American university. If Willie Munzenberg has his way, that's what will happen to every single American family, and not just American family, but every single family in the world, what's left of them, because there's a deep-seated and long-standing depopulation agenda that these Talmudic types have been pushing all along, right? And be careful what you ask for, you Talmudic types. Total depopulation, right? Because if you wiped everybody out, there's no one left to, you know, force into sex slavery. There's no one else to compel and encourage and promote perversity and bestiality and everything else, and there'll be no one left to, no nations left to pit against each other in these wars that only you benefit from. There will be no one left to sicken, you know, with your allopathic medicine and, you know, get addicted to your pharmaceuticals, you know. Be careful what you wish for. I mean, where's the fun in that? If there's no one around to mess with, it's like, you know, so what's the point, right? You know, from your standpoint. So just be careful what you wish for. Anyhow, reach the end of this long segment of Bartley's commentaries on the cosmic wars. I just wanted to add my 2 cents worth of, and talk about the School of Frankfurt and the malign influence it's played on society as we know it. I mean, everything, all the basic tenets of the School of Frankfurt are right there. They're being played out right in front of us. So anyhow, we will overcome, folks. It's always the darkest before the dawn, right? We will overcome all this stuff, but we just need to know where all this stuff came from. And ultimately, it came from a very dark nether dimension, this demiurgic AI spirit that has permeated into our plane of existence and is seeking to totally subjugate everyone and everything in this plane of existence. But if we do what we're here to do, that many of you know you're here to do, if we carry out our mission, then this won't happen. This nightmare of a Borg society for, you know, what's left of humanity being plugged into the Borg collective. Anyhow, wherever you may be, dear listeners, whatever you may be doing, please have a very pleasant time, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye for now.